The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 21st message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 24th, 2026.
We're going to carry forward with this series of the survey of the books of Samuel in the life of King David. For reason, we are highlighting the decisions, especially that David made under pressure, and he was under a lot of pressure throughout the majority of his life. And what really sets him apart, and ultimately, and I keep bringing you back to the fact that in the final analysis, God called David a man after his own heart. And it not because he didn't make any mistakes. He made a lot of mistakes in his life. But there was something different about his orientation compared to everyone else around him. And especially in contrast to the behavior and the orientation of mind of King Saul. So I think Saul versus David in mind and the orientation of decision making tells a really important story, which is especially valuable to the people of God. And again, the point of this is not just to tell a Bible story. It's not just like reading story to your children for the sake of entertainment. This is about us deriving some value from these storylines of individuals and what they did and how they were thinking and what drove them to do certain things at given times and the whys and wherefores. And we haven't even hardly even scratched it concerning David. He's still a young man. We're just getting started with the kind of decisions that he's going to make going forward, which I think are very, very inspirational. But in quick summary, last time we covered all of 1 Samuel chapter 20, covering the new personal covenant made between David and Jonathan, a reconfirmation of their covenant of friendship before. But in this case now, David has promised by Jonathan's admonition to not only to take care of Jonathan, because Jonathan is assuming and taking for granted that David's going to be the king of Israel, even though he's their parent, which is really phenomenal. But Jonathan, sees the writing on the wall. Really what he's doing is gauging the fruits and seeing that God is absolutely backing this young man and is behind him. Unlike his father Saul, Jonathan is taking that seriously, and he wants to be on God's side in this, which means he has aligned himself with David, which is an absolute wise thing to do. But he understands that from a human standpoint, he's putting himself and his children and his future progeny absolutely at risk, because the typical thing to happen is that the new king with a new dynasty is going to try to totally extinguish all of the heirs of the old dynasty. That's just smart. And so Jonathan literally is putting himself in David's hands with this covenant, trusting when David vows, which he did, that he is going to not only protect Jonathan, he's going to protect the children of Jonathan for future generations. And I've already given you the answer in the back of the book. He is going to do that when we get down now years hence. We also saw that at the new moon feast that Saul proves his intent to kill David. He was trying to play his cards close to the vest, so to speak, but came out with his absolute intent to kill David. Jonathan warns David in advance so that David can get away. And in doing so now, Jonathan incurs the wrath of his own father, which is a breach which is never truly going to be healed. All right, so now David is on the run. We're starting now in 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1. We're going to try and get through this whole chapter, which is not a long chapter, but there's a number of important elements in this storyline of chapter 21, which is going to cause us to diverge and go on a few little tangents, just letting you know in advance. The first point I want to make here, 1 Samuel 21, verse 1 says, Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And so now he's fleeing, he's on the run. So before we now get into this, let me make this point. From this time forward in the storyline, David is never reconciled, even for a short time, with King Saul. There will be periods where Saul is not pursuing him relentlessly. But under no circumstance is David ever going to be welcomed back to the court of King Saul in Gibeah. He's never going to have a place at Saul's table like he has up until this time. So from now on, until Saul dies, David is the enemy of King Saul. So everything we see in the storyline throughout the remainder of 1 Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel, is in essence this animosity now. And David is absolutely on the run for his life. All right, so David goes to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. All right, what do we know about this? Ahimelech, in essence, is acting in the role of the high priest. Why Nob? This is a little tiny village, a few miles from Gibeah, not far from Saul's court at all. Why does he go to Nob? This is actually where the tabernacle is, and this is where the Ark of the Covenant is. This is where the high priest is now fulfilling the responsibilities of the tabernacle service, according to the instructions that God gave through Moses. Who is this Ahimelech? Okay, what is his pedigree, if you will? Well, he is the great-grandson of Eli, and you remember Eli. Okay, so Eli, his son, remember he had two sons, and both of them were no account, Hophni and Phinehas, all right? And Hophni, Phinehas, and Eli all died on the same day or within a number of hours of each other. Remember that event where the Philistines literally beat the Israelites in a major battle, took the ark captive. Hophni and Phinehas both were killed in the battle, and then when Eli found out about it, he fell over backward and died. Okay, and you remember that because we've been through that element. All right, but Phinehas already had children, and one of them was a man named Ahitub, A-H-I-T-U-B. Ahitub then had his son, who is this Ahimelech, all right? So that's the pedigree now coming down, which means he is a legitimate, not only a Levite, but he certainly then is of the line of the priests of the house of Aaron. So he legitimately holds this office of the high priesthood. All right. The tabernacle had moved to Nob, this priestly city, which is, as I said, a short distance away from Gibeah, maybe only 4 or 5 miles. And that is all about maybe 6 miles north of Jerusalem, just for perspective if you're looking on your Bible map. The ark was placed here after it was recovered from the Philistines. Remember, it went 7 months through the 5 major cities of the Philistines before they gave it back. It spent years in one city in the borderlands, and then ultimately about 20 years later was moved to this little town of Nob. All of that happened about 60 years after the death of Eli and his son. So where are we on the timeline? Samuel, who is not a key figure in the storyline anymore, he's probably in his 80s by now. Remember, when Samuel was a little boy, when he first was given over to Eli's guardianship, and ultimately came to his maturity around 20, probably when Eli and Hophni and Phinehas were killed, and then became the key prophet in Israel. And now you're looking at least 60 years later after that event, so in the timeline. What else do we know about, and again, I'll go back and I don't want to dwell on this, but I like to have some sort of a reference in my mind for the storytelling about the ages of the characters. How old is David at this point? It all depends on how old he was when he killed Goliath. But we're not talking about a huge amount of time that's been displaced since David came on the scene as a youth, as a teenager. Are we talking 2 years hence? Are we talking 3 years? I doubt that it was much more than that. So it depends on if you think David was 16 when he killed Goliath. Was he 17? I'm going to say 17. We don't know. But I'm going to, you know, build this little timeline to say, and I'm going to give it a maximum of 3 years that he's been in Saul's court. With Saul's jealousy, it doesn't make sense to me, especially because the jealousy that came up with Saul toward David, that he could endure very long before it erupted into these final acts that we've already read about in chapter 20. Maybe so, maybe not. But I'm assuming that David at this point now, where he's going to start his flight as an outcast, he's about 20, maybe. Now, the only other anchors we have is, and I went through this before, but just to give you a quick reminder, we know the book of Acts tells us that Saul reigned over Israel for 40 years. Okay, so the entire length of his kingship was a 40-year period. We also know, we're going to see in the storyline here in 1 Samuel, that when Saul dies and David begins to rule at least over the tribe of Judah, he doesn't rule over all of Israel at one time. It takes him 7 years before he becomes the king over the whole thing. So immediately the Jews are going to embrace him and he's going to be king over Judah. Well, that happens when he's 30 years old. So now we went through and made the presumption based upon the age of Jonathan and everything else, having already been a soldier, even though a young man, in the earlier storyline, that Saul, before David comes on the scene, Saul's been ruling at least 20 years. At least 20 years before this provocation with Samuel that caused God to remove his blessing from him. David comes on the scene sometime after that. Is it 25 years into Saul's reign? We don't know. How long until the 40 years of Saul is up? Is it 10 years? Is it 15 years? We don't know. I'm trying to answer the question, how long is David going to be on the run? The scholars don't agree, and God didn't choose to tell us precisely. But if David is approximately 19 or 20, and he begins to reign in Judah at age 30, that's 10 years on the run. Now, some commentators, they think it's more like 5 or 6 years on the run. Others think it's as many as 15. I'm just going to split the difference and say 10 years. Doesn't matter. But literally from the time he killed Goliath, if there's only, let's say, a 3-year period, if it was 17 and now he's 20, and there's 10 years on the run before he becomes king when Saul dies, just to give you a perspective of how long he's going to be literally an outcast and fighting for his life. That's the timeline. So from chapter 21 here on, this is what the majority of the rest of 1 Samuel is going to be about. All right, we're still in verse 1. Then came David the Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David. Why? And said unto him, why art thou alone and no man with thee? Okay, that gives you a hint. Remember, David was a renowned champion in Israel. Even if it's only been 2 or 3 years since he killed Goliath, in the meantime, remember we saw all the accounts where he distinguished himself among the army and the people of Israel. He's got a rep. And he is recognized as a champion of Israel, which is why Saul is jealous. So David has been in charge of hundreds and even up to 1,000 or more soldiers in major battles where he has earned a reputation as a warrior, killing all the Philistines. He's married the king's daughter. All right. And now all of a sudden, David shows up alone. And the high priest is like, hey, this doesn't seem to mesh. What is going on here? Why art thou alone and no man with you? Was there absolutely no one accompanying David? That doesn't seem to be the case. But by comparison, he's not at the head of a big troop of soldiers like everyone would expect to see. If David is out, roaming around, he expects it to be as a general at the head of an army. And here he shows up alone. Verse 2, and David said unto Ahimelech the priest, well, the king is trying to kill me, and so I'm on the run for my life. No, that's not what he says. David lies. David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king hath commanded me a business. I'm on a special mission from the king, a secret mission. And hath said unto me, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee. and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. So I'm on this secret mission to go and carry out the king's duties around the country for things that I can't tell you. That's his story. Verse 3, now therefore, what is under your hand? Meaning he's asking Ahimelech, hey, what food you got? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever, or what there is present, whatever you've got. In other words, he's hungry. Verse 4, and the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread under my hand, but there is hallowed bread. So I think that's very interesting. There's no, and maybe he's saying because they're right there in the precinct of the tabernacle. You would think the high priest at home or other peoples in the little village that there would be food available. But the priest says, there's no available food for you. There's no common bread under my hand, but there is hallowed bread. And we're going to talk about this more. Let me read through verse 6 and then we'll come back and analyze. The priest says, if the young men, so now you find out there are actually men accompanying David. He's not all by himself. He has a small band or a troop with him. If the young men have kept themselves at least from women, and David answered the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out. So David is in essence saying he left the king's court. He claimed on this secret mission, you know, if he's not lying here, he's been on the run about 3 days, which would account for the reason why whatever food he had has been expended. Of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. What's that about? We're going to find out. Verse 6, so the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before the Eternal to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. Now, if you didn't know anything about the commands of God through Moses to ancient Israel for the conduct of the tabernacle worship and the service, you'd have no clue what's going on. Thankful we do know. But at this moment, we find David does have a band of men with him. So at some point, not told in the storyline, when he first escaped, when Jonathan gave him the word, you got to get out of here, my dad's trying to kill you, and he went on the run, somewhere along the line, he picked up probably his most staunch supporters from his army, the ones he could absolutely trust, his inner circle, if you will. And now this small band together is on the run and show up at the tabernacle with the high priest. They have perhaps been hiding out for 3 days, if David's not lying at this point, remaining in the same general area. We're not talking about a long distance. You're talking about in the same precinct, within 3 to 5 miles at most. But now they're out of food. All right, what about this showbread? And what is this priest talking about? And what is David talking about in relationship to the showbread? All right, I'm not going to go into a big detail on this. I'm going to give you the chapters in the Old Testament that tell you. All right, the primary biblical rules concerning the showbread come from Exodus 25, specifically verses 23 through 30. That describes the table that the showbread was to sit on, which was inside the tabernacle in the primary room. You've got it basically the tabernacle, later the temple was divided in the larger room, and then the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant rested, where no one was able to enter. Okay, except for the high priest once a year on atonement. All right, so in this main room of the tabernacle, still the only ones allowed to enter there are the priests. So not even regular Levites. You had to be specifically of the house of Aaron to be a priest and to be able to do any of the work inside the tabernacle. And in that room included the brazen altar, it included the golden lampstand, and it included this table. And so the instructions that God gave through Moses for building this table that would be housed inside the tabernacle, you can find that then in Exodus 25. All right. And it basically, it's a very expensive wooden table covered in gold. It's not a big table if you look at the dimensions of it. But on this table then sat the showbread. And what was the showbread? 12 loaves of bread that were baked every week fresh for the new Sabbath day. Okay. Now the instructions for the bread and how to make the bread, that you can find in Leviticus 24, verse 5 through 9. That details everything about the bread, the way the priests were supposed to bake it and put it on this table. So what do we know? In summary, the preparation, 12 loaves or cakes were baked from fine flour. Each loaf in the instruction in Leviticus 24 used 2/10 of an ephah. Well, what does that convert to? The scholars say that converts to about 4 to 5 pounds of flour. And every loaf had this recipe. So I'm like, I'm not a cook and I don't bake bread, but it's like 4 or 5 pounds of flour. That's a pretty big loaf. Okay. And there were 12 of them. And new ones were baked every week. And they were unleavened, no leavening. So these weren't puffy, you know, Wonder Bread type loaves. This is thick bread, large loaves of dense bread. All right, what else do we know? Each one of those loaves signified one of the 12 tribes of Israel. This is all God's instruction to the priests through Moses. All right, what's the arrangement? The loaves were placed on this table of pure gold overlaid in the holy place in the tabernacle, arranged in two rows, 6 loaves to each row, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. What else do we know about it? The command also says from Leviticus 24 that pure frankincense was placed in cups or bowls. The presumption is the cups and bowls doesn't say specifically in Leviticus 24, but The frankincense apparently wasn't mixed in with the bread, but it was there as for a sweet-smelling savor. So some sort of containers on this table along with the bread was placed on top of each row as a memorial offering. This frankincense was later burned on the altar, also as an offering before God. What else do we know? Placement and renewal of the bread. The bread was to remain, quote, before the eternal at all times. That's Exodus 25, verse 30. There was always to be these loaves of unleavened bread in the tabernacle on this gold-covered table at all times. This was part of the worship of the one true God commanded of Israel. All right. And it symbolizes God's constant presence. I'm not going to go into all the symbolism, which you all will put together a lot, when Jesus Christ called himself the bread of life. Okay? So we know spiritually the fulfillment of this physical requirement in the first covenant of this tabernacle arrangement was that Christ would be the food for man. And first of all, to the church, those that are called, and through the Holy Spirit. And that's why in the Gospels, in his ministry, he said, you know, anyone who basically wants to find God or come into me, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood, which blew everybody's mind. He's talking symbolically about what it means to partake of Christ and who he is and what he means in the plan of God. And so, you know, Christ also, you know, spoke about this bread from heaven. Manna was a symbol for this. So all of these different symbols of food in relation to unleavened bread, all right, is all about Jesus Christ. But the physical example that we're talking about here, the bread was to remain before the eternal at all times. That's Exodus 25, verse 30. So there always had to be bread, symbolizing God's constant presence. Fresh, hot loaves were placed on the table every Sabbath. So I'm like, okay, when was the new loaves baked? Was it baked on Friday for the Sabbath? Did they do it Sabbath morning? And you say, oh, you weren't able to. able to do that on the Sabbath? Well, the priests did a whole lot of servile work. Well, they did labor on the Sabbath in order to fulfill God's commands for everything that had to be done, especially on Sabbaths and holy days. There was a lot of physical labor, but it wasn't considered servile work because it was God-commanded work. Was the baking of this bread, did this take place on early Sabbath morning? I don't know. The instructions do not tell us. We just know that every Sabbath there were 12 freshly baked loaves of this unleavened bread that were now put on the table. And then what would happen to the old loaves that are a week old? This is the bread that we're talking about now that David and his men are going to eat. Not the showbread that is on the table as an offering and a representation to God. That absolutely one would have been a serious offense to partake of the, I'm going to call it the active showbread. But what we're talking about is once the new bread is put on the table, now you've got these 12 loaves which are taken off. And what was to be done with that? These old loaves then were eaten by the high priest and his children, the sons, in the holy place, in the sanctuary, in the tabernacle. So it was considered, even though they were the old loaves, they were retired from their week of presentation on the table. They were still considered holy as their portion from the Lord's offering. That's Leviticus 24, verse 9. That's what those loaves are called. So the high priest and his children, who were literally doing the work of the tabernacle, worship and the service, this is what they ate. This is kind of like having a meal provided for you on the job. So that, in concert, by the way, with all of the animal sacrifices that they would have managed during the week for anyone who brought free will offerings, including peace offerings and others. So the priest would have a meal of meat, whether it was beef or lamb or pigeons or turtle doves, and this unleavened bread, the leftover show bread. Okay. I want to say, where's the fresh vegetables and fruit? There's no salad in here. They're eating meat and bread. Anyway, so no one else besides the priests were allowed to eat it, and it was only eaten inside the tabernacle. Only priests could go in. Now, Jesus used this very event to teach a spiritual principle. So turn over with me to Matthew 12, verse 1. I'm going to read quickly through verses 1 through 8. Matthew 12, beginning in verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, meaning the grain fields. This isn't corn on the cob. All right? It's the word in the Greek which refers to grain. And his disciples were and hungered and began to pluck the ears of the corn, meaning the heads of the grain, and to eat. They're just walking through the fields, kind of shucking a little bit of grain and popping it in their mouth on their way. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, "Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day." Your disciples are breaking the law. But he, Jesus, said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? And they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests." What we've just described. Verse 5, Jesus says further, "Or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" Aha, see, here's Christ's reference to the fact that the priests actually did work on the Sabbath, but were not considered by God to be profaning the Sabbath, because the work they were doing was God instituted for the work of the tabernacle. Different category. Christ said, verse 6, "But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. Yeah, they didn't even recognize they were literally dealing with the Son of God, who was the God of the Old Testament, who commanded through Moses all of those ordinances. And here he was standing in the flesh, and they didn't recognize him. Verse 7, but if you had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. Verse 8, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Who are we going to look to tell us what's okay and not okay to do on the Sabbath? The Pharisees, or in our day, these Johnny-come-latelys, these Tom, Dick, and Harrys who want to say that by their scholarship or whatever else, they can tell us what's okay and what's not? Christ is saying they don't have any authority. Christ says, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And so he is the one that we look to tell us how to keep the Sabbath appropriately, both physically and spiritually. Well, he made specific reference to this very fact that the high priest allowed David and his men to eat the showbread. So my question is not only, and I don't see it addressed. It's like the question that falls in the crack. They eat the showbread, but my further question is, where did they eat the showbread? The showbread was always supposed to stay in the tabernacle. So even when it was retired and then eaten by the priest, it was supposed to be consumed inside the tabernacle. And I'm assuming any crumbs or anything that were left over would have been burned on the altar, which had the coals of fire, which persisted nonstop. So the showbread was never supposed to exit the tabernacle. So my question further is, where did David and his men eat it? Were they permitted inside the tabernacle? Were only priests of the family of Aaron were allowed? Or did the high priest also violate another principle, technically, by bringing the showbread outside to allow David and his men? I've never heard anybody address that. I think scholars, I'm sure they will, and everybody will have an opinion. We just don't have an answer to that. But what I'm telling you is when Christ confirmed that David eating the showbread was permissible under the circumstance, because there was a need. They were, in essence, out of food and starving to death. All right? And so Christ is the one who tells us, in this case, the high priest was not doing a disservice or disrespecting God for allowing David and his men to eat the showbread. And I would say, whether the showbread then came outside the tabernacle or David and his men were let inside the tabernacle, either way, that was another element that Christ did not condemn. Christ here said in Matthew 12, verse 4, how he entered into the house of God. So the account in 1 Samuel we're reading doesn't say anything about where they were, inside or outside. The only reference we have is Christ's statement here. Now he says how he, David, entered into the house of God. So if I'm just going to take that at face value, I'm going to assume literally the high priest allowed David and his men to enter into the tabernacle. Sanctuary. I don't know how else to take it. There's a lot of scholars that won't say, oh, no, they would have done this or that, or blah, blah, blah. I don't care about that. I just know what I read right here. This is not an excuse for lax Sabbath keeping, which is how people will take it. Oh, well, see, God doesn't really care if something important comes up on the Sabbath. Oh, I'm called in unexpectedly to have to work because there's a crisis. Well, see, David ate the showbread. Or whatever else. No, be very, very careful about trying to construe an allowance. That's not what Christ said. Luke 14, verse 2, by the way. Here's the ox in the ditch principle that Christ also expounded. Luke 14, verse 2, and behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers of the Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? Now, so before Jesus creates the miracle, he's in essence, he knows what these Pharisees are going to do. He's getting ready to provoke them by performing a miracle. And before he does it, he challenges them on their authority to try and tell what's lawful or not lawful on the Sabbath. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they held their peace. They were smart enough to know it's not a good time to answer. And he took him, Jesus took this sick man, healed him and let him go, and answered them saying, which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? Literally, if you had an animal that was in distress because it fell into a pit and it happened to be on a Saturday, you'd say, sorry, I have to wait till sunset before I pull my animal out. Jesus is showing, no, there is an ox in the ditch principle here. That's where this comes from. Verse 6, and they could not answer him again on these things. So there are circumstances when it's beyond our control to prepare for to use Friday as a preparation day, to do everything we possibly can to make sure we do not engage in servile work on the Sabbath, but unexpected things can happen beyond our control. We just need to be very, very careful about deciding what fits into that category, because it's very easy to be the one who throws your ox into the ditch, and you don't get credit for that. All right, back to 1 Samuel 21. What about these ritual purity laws concerning being clean? Go back, let's reread verses 4 and 5 again. Here, the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread under my hand, but there is hallowed bread. If the young men have kept themselves at least from women. All right, what's this about? We're not talking about, oh, it's been a few days since I was guilty of fornicating. The presumption here is lawful intercourse with a mate. Okay? Because there is no provision for justifying adultery or fornication. Those technically came with a death penalty. David answered the priest, verse 5, and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days, meaning they've been away from their homes, and the ones that are married, they haven't been around their wives. Since I came out, he says, and the vessels of the young men, meaning their bodies or their persons, are holy. All right, what is this about? Well, this refers back to the command God gave in Leviticus 15. I'll read this quickly, Leviticus 15, 16 through 18. And here is the principle. If any man's seed of copulation go out from him, then he shall wash all his flesh in water and be unclean until the even, meaning until sunset. And every garment and every skin whereon is the seed of copulation shall be washed with water and be unclean until the even. The woman also with whom man shall lie with seed of copulation, they shall both bathe themselves in water and be unclean until even. All right. The principle that continues on is cleanliness. That never goes out of style. What is part of the first covenant of these purity laws, which were temporary and were done away with the sacrifice of Christ, is this idea of these purification principles, which said you're considered unclean or not purified until sunset. All right, and I'm not going into a big thing to try and justify or to prove that. I'm just telling you, this is that which is done away. It does not apply today for us. And by the way, if you have a question about this, should married couples be having sex on the Sabbath? Well, Mr. Cole, in his series on how to keep the Sabbath years ago, said, I remember him saying, is it wrong to love on the Sabbath? Because in a legitimate relationship between a husband and a wife, sexual intercourse is an expression of love. Now, there's a lot of things that cannot be an expression of love. But when it's correct, with the right orientation, it is not wrong. So anybody who wants to take this principle that applied, and now we're going to see in Exodus 19, verse 14 and 15, it carried over with God's special instruction to the priests. Before they came on duty to do their official service in the tabernacle, they were required to abstain from sexual relations with their wives. Read that in Exodus 19:14. Moses went down from the mount. Well, this one, the one I picked out here for you, is when the entire nation was before meeting with God. When he came down on Mount Sinai and literally uttered with his own voice the Ten Commandments. And in preparation, Moses went down from the mountain unto the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. And he said unto the people, be ready against the third day. Come not at your wives. So physically, for a physical people, not called, who don't have the Holy Spirit, this idea of setting yourself apart and doing something different than you normally would do in anticipation of meeting with God. And part of this, to make the point, was that God then said, you shouldn't have intercourse with your lawful wife. Okay. So this was also a rule, and I won't turn to it, for the priests before they did their official service, if they were coming on to their assignment at the tabernacle. In order to be ritualistically pure, then they started with at least a sunset before having intercourse with their wives. So now the high priest, so that's why this is coming up. The high priest is about to make an exception to allow David and his men to eat this hallowed bread. But what he's saying is they minimally need to meet the same kind of purity standards that the priest would in order for them to eat the bread, even though they're not priests. That's what's going on here. All right. Verse 7. Here we find there's a spy in their midst. 1 Samuel 21, verse 7, now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Eternal. What does that mean? We don't know for certain. I'll comment on it in a moment. It says, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. So what do we know? Doeg was a high-ranking officer under Saul, even though he was an Edomite, meaning he was not an Israelite, he was a descendant of Esau. And yet he is a trusted officer of King Saul. He is over all of the king's livestock. And if you think, well, that's not very prestigious, but a lot of the wealth was in animals. And if you're in charge of all of the livestock owned and possessed by the king himself, that's a prestigious position. So that's who this Doeg is. He is remembered, because you're going to find out in the next chapter. We're not going to cover it today in chapter 21, but you'll get to it in chapter 22. He's remembered as a self-serving, bloodthirsty traitor, an outsider who ingratiated himself with Saul through malice and proved himself capable of betrayal, false piety, and lying. Because that's what's going to happen. And a lot of people are going to die because of him. But not to get ahead of the story, picking it up in verse 8. So back to this question. What does it mean he was detained before the Eternal? There was some reason he held over in Nob here at the tabernacle. Now, as an Edomite, non-Israelite, he was not allowed the same privileges as other Israelites. Like I say, no one except the priest. Even if you were an Israelite, if you weren't of the house of Aaron, you couldn't go inside the tabernacle. So some scholars want to say, well, he was there fulfilling some sort of vow. He was a proselyte, supposedly, even though he wasn't an Israelite. But God made provision for non-Israelites to live in the land of Israel and to have a lot of the privileges if they showed respect to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and things that they did. Okay, so ostensibly Doeg is one of these proselytes, that's what they call it, showing respect in some way. So is he making a vow? Is he fulfilling some sort of an obligation? Some argue it was just a weekly Sabbath, and therefore instead of going on to Gibeah, to Saul, he actually held over and kept the Sabbath there in Nob. Nobody knows. Okay. But for some reason, he was there. It was God's will, above all else, that Doeg was there and actually saw David and his men. All right. So hold that, because we'll cover that next time. But verse 8, David said unto Ahimelech, all right, now they've had their bread, their bellies are full again, they're all fat and sassy. Is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? Now he's asking for weapons. Interesting, you go to the high priest of the tabernacle to ask if you got any weapons laying around. For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me. Here's the continuation of the lie. Because the king's business required haste. The king sent me out on his special spy mission so quickly I didn't even have time to take my weapons with me. That's pretty laughable, actually. So what's the reality? David is here without his normal accoutrement of armor and weapons, which means he had no opportunity. Once Jonathan gave him the warning, my father is out to get you, you got to run, and you got to run now. He had no chance to try to get to his house in Gibeah to retrieve anything. He literally had to run for it and pick up his men along the way. So no weapons. Verse 9, and the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah, behold, it's here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. Oh, what do you know? In the tabernacle, in the same chamber we're talking about with the brazen altar and the table with the showbread and the golden candlestick, is also, now what's the ephod? The ephod literally was the high priest's garments. And he would only put them on once he entered in to the tabernacle chamber, and then he would change his clothes and go through the ritual washing and then put on this linen robe. It had the breastplate that also had the Urim and the Thummim. Okay? So, but then he didn't go outside the tabernacle with his high priest clothing that was considered holy to perform his office. It stayed inside the tabernacle, which means apparently they had some sort of a rack or a peg or something that this would hang on. And what Ahimelech is saying is, oh yeah, Goliath's sword is wrapped up and it's kind of right there. Maybe in the corner, leaning up against the wall, I don't know. But it was behind where the high priest's garments were hanging. If thou wilt take that, take it. The high priest is saying, you know what? You're the one that took it, as a battle prize. If you want that sword, go ahead and take it. For there is no other save that here. There's no other weapon here except Goliath's sword. And David said, there is none like that. Give it me. He's saying, ooh, yeah, that's exactly what I need. All right. This brings us up to verse 10. Now David flees. He's going to leave Nob, and where is he going to go? Where can he go? He's not safe anywhere in Israel. Saul's after him. He's got spies everywhere. So what does David do? He takes his men. Verse 10, and David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. What are we talking about? He went into the territory of the Philistines. And remember, the city of Gath, one of the major cities of the Philistines, fortified cities. Who was from Gath? Goliath. Goliath was of Gath. That's where he was born and raised. So wait a minute. You're telling me that within, let's say, 2 or 3 years prior to this event, David just slew the giant of Gath and took his sword, cut his head off, and now David's going to Gath, basically taking the sword of Goliath with him. Irony of ironies. And why is he doing this? He's looking for a place to hide out. Now, remember, some claim that Achish, who is like this king, this mini king over the city of Gath, remember they had kings throughout the entire province of that the Philistines controlled, was basically a king over every one of the major cities. So the scholars again want to debate on who this Achish was. Some claim that it may have been a title like Pharaoh, meaning this wasn't a person's name. But the same way in Egypt, Pharaoh, if the Pharaoh dies and the new leader comes on the scene, he's also called Pharaoh. So some scholars want to say that this Achish is actually a title of that they gave to whoever was in charge. I think that's really weak. Again, if we're only talking about 2 to 3 years since the time David slew Goliath, which is kind of one of the reasons why I gave you all of that rehearsal on potential timelines and ages and all of that, it's not been that long. This is very likely the very same magistrate king over the city of Gath that was there during the big battle when Goliath was slain. Very likely the very same king. It does not confirm it absolutely. My presumption is that it's the very same man. All right. Why would David go there? The account here does not tell us for certain. My presumption from the things that happened that we're going to read from verse 11 to the end is that he went incognito. He didn't just show up and say, ta-da, I'm David, the one that killed your giant. Here I am with his sword. That apparently is not what happened. He was trying to get out of Saul's domain. He was trying to escape where he was most immediately at danger of being killed, which means he needed to leave the borders that were controlled by the Israelites. And the closest place, because they don't live that far away from the borderlands with the Philistines. He could have gone east, he could have gone south, he could have gone north. The very fastest way to get out of Israelite control was to go to the land of the Philistines. And Gath was the nearest major city. So circumstance. I mean, this is the way things can happen in life. And if you've ever felt, you know, had these things happen where you did things and ended up in places you never would have thought and you never would have planned it if it was in your control, but you felt forced through circumstance to go a certain way or do a certain thing, and then you ended up. I don't know it. We don't get the details. God didn't choose to record it. But that's how I read in myself when I see this story. Ironically, David ends up seeking refuge incognito in the very heart of those who would love to take revenge on him. Verse 11, and the servants of Achish said unto him, is not this David, the king of the land? Isn't interesting? They're calling David the king of the land. Saul would have hated that. But this was the reputation young David already had. And again, I'm presuming he's around 20 years old now. Maybe younger, maybe older. I'm presuming about 20 years old, which is the age of majority, by the way. His servants, it's not that the king, David doesn't announce himself, ta-da, here I am with my band. He's there, and it takes certain of this inner court of the king of Gath to actually recognize David. They are the ones who called it out, which is why I'm presuming that David was actually trying to hide. And he thought the best way to hide, let me go to the last place Saul would expect me to go. Maybe that was the rationale. And then he could live actually incognito without either the Philistines knowing who he was and out of the reach of King Saul. I understand that. That would be a bold plan, but it certainly could have worked. So the servants of the king said, is not this David, the king of the land? And did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000? Philistines knew fully well everything going on in Israel. And the reputation that David had garnered among all of the nation, including the song that the women sang when they came through after that battle and Goliath was killed. The Philistines had all their own intelligence to know these things. So David apparently is trying to hide, but now he is found out. So now he needs a plan B. Verse 12, and David laid up these words in his heart. When he found out that these close counselors of the king of Gath recognized him, and now they're tipping off the king and saying, hey, this is none other than David, the David. David laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he didn't intend to be, he didn't go there expecting to be in danger. He thought he could hide. Now he's afraid because the jig is up. Verse 13, and he, David, changed his behavior. He's already there in the city. What's he going to do? It's too late to run. So David comes up with another scheme of deception. He changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad. He pretended to be insane in their hands and scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. He had to be a great actor. Probably an Oscar, level award performance. And physically, not taking into consideration God's special protection and help for David, it apparently saved his life. So to avoid the revenge of these Philistines, who would have loved nothing better than to kill him and make a spectacle of him for having defeated them in battle and killed Goliath, their champion, David pretends to be insane. Verse 14, and it must have worked. Then said Achish unto his servants, lo, you see the man is mad. Can't you tell he's absolutely stark raving nuts? Wherefore then have you brought him to me? This is the first time we find out too. Crazy David was actually brought to the king. So David wasn't already in the audience of the king. Apparently he was somewhere else within the fortress or the gates of the city. These counselors of the king find him out and it appears took him into custody. Nothing is said here except they brought him to the king. Otherwise, the king didn't see him, didn't know he was there. Wherefore then, the king says, have you brought him to me? Why have you brought this crazy man for an audience in front of me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? So in essence, he chastises his servants, his counselor, his inner circle. It's like, why think this is important enough? Okay, so it's David, but look at him now. What are we going to get, by doing anything or prosecuting this guy now? He's obviously lost his mind, which takes all the fun out of it. So to avoid the revenge of the Philistines, he pretends to be insane, and then here, what we find at the very end and leading into chapter 22, David has an opportunity now to escape again. This time he's escaping from the Philistines. He was escaping from Saul, thought he could find a refuge with the Philistines. He can't find a refuge there. He's on the run again. So next time, we'll continue with the story of David in chapter 22 and the continuing exploits.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 21st message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 24th, 2026. Thank you.